Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to remind viewers that entertainment is not mindless.
Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 125, with guest Joel Mayward, who writes and reviews at his site, CineMayward, and also Reverend Alan Hawkins from Church of the Redeemer right here in Greensboro, North Carolina. So listen up, because we've got another really great show for you. On this episode, we talk silence and the cross of Christ.
I want to have some kind of really cool way to like kick this episode off or have some kind of transitional kind of conversation to have. But I feel like there's so much to talk about in silence that if we waste too much time chatting about this or that, then we've honestly just wasted time.
The night is young.
Well, that's the problem. The night is not young.
For Joel.
For Joel.
I got all the time in the world.
Joel's like...
hours and hours.
Kids are in bed.
Right.
You know, it's like the evening's just started. The sun probably just set over there.
Sun's coming up here soon.
So it'll be like midnight before we're done over here.
Bring it.
I think one of the hardest things with silence is that it's so long that I wanted to watch it like multiple times to really catch a lot of like the subtle things because, you know, it's a Scorsese film. So everything probably matters, you know. I don't want to deal necessarily in absolutes about Scorsese, but, you know, everything probably matters. And just finding 3 hours to watch a film twice, especially in a season heading into award season when I'm trying to catch so many films anyway. Oh, so I feel no matter how many times I would have or could have seen this film, I feel like I would have been woefully ill-prepared. But there are so many people having so many great conversations about this movie, which is what I'm very excited about, that I think it's okay if we don't hit everything. And I don't want to do that thing that I've heard you talk about before, Alan, when you hear people get up and they're going to say a sermon and like, oh, well, I didn't have time to prepare this, so I'm sorry that it's bad. I'm not trying to prep an episode saying, like, I'm sorry this episode's bad ahead
of
time.
But you are.
I'm not. I am saying that there is no way that we will cover everything.
Right.
So, yeah, because there's literally too much going on. I mean, the book would not be as popular as it was if it was surface and like had one theme running through it. You know, and I think the movie being, from everything that I'm to understand, an accurate, about as faithful as you can get, a translation from the book to film, is not going to be simple either.
Sure.
So, Joel, I have you here, and Alan, I have you here, and we're going to do the best we can to get through as much of this as possible, because this is a film... again, Scorsese's, it's been called his passion project. He's been trying to get this film made for like 20 plus years. It's got it's hard to say an all-star cast, but it's got a solid cast. I love the fact that it actually has like Japanese actors doing Japanese things in it. I feel like so many times recently we're having like,
Matt Damon
in a Chinese wall movie.
Yeah,
Which really... is supposed to have a reason, I'm told. But, sure. You know, we're told by the director, but
we'll see.
You know, it's so many things being whitewashed or being accused of being whitewashed. It's nice to Scorsese really seemed like to double down on doing it right. So, I guess the first thing I'm really curious about now that I've been talking for tons and tons of time is what your interactions or your familiarity with the subject matter was before you went in to see the film. Because I think we're all three in separate places from some conversations, and I want to kind of get that out there to start. So, Joel, what did you know about this film before you went to see it? whether it was like interactions with the book or just, you know, marketing or whatever. Like what your, not necessarily your expectations, but what was your familiarity with the subject matter?
So I had read Endo's novel years ago, having read a book by Philip Yancey. And now I can't remember the name of that book, but it was a list of a bunch of different authors and thinkers and writers and Christians who had shaped him. And Endo was one of those that he listed. And so I picked up the novel Silence and I read it. And this was maybe a decade ago. And it was profound. It made an impact on me and was instantly one of those things that I know I'm going to read this again. And I held on to that and have referenced that over the years in ministry contexts and things like that. And then I heard, gosh, I can't even remember now, but years ago about Scorsese's desire to make Silence into a film and to adapt that and multiple plans that he had and how it kept falling through, how you would lose funding or, you know, people would back out. And I remember at one point Daniel Day-Lewis was attached to the project, I think, and then that person ended up being Liam Neeson. So I'm still trying to imagine what that would have been like, having Daniel Day-Lewis as part of this. And then when it finally happened and I knew that it was actually going to be released and there was a trailer, it finally felt like a reality, because it's one of those films similar to like a Terrence Malick film that you hear about coming out for years and years and it's being made and being edited and then it never actually, you can't believe the release date because it's going to get pushed back. And I knew it was coming out in 2016. But even then I didn't get to see it until early 2017 because of the way that it was released. But I had the opportunity to read the book again before watching the film. Mm. So, and then I watched the film twice in theaters. So I have soaked myself in Silence, I guess is a good way to put it.
You have encompassed full immersion.
Yeah.
Well, I like what you're saying about the release date too, because I remember, and I'm pretty sure you can go back on Real World Theology and check this out, but we got together as a staff and did, I remember doing our most anticipated of, I think 2015, and it was rumored that Silence would be released like right at the end of 2015, like a, you know, late December, possible awards kind of thing. And so it made our, it was our most anticipated of 2015 and 2016. And like you're saying, I didn't actually get to see it technically until 2017. So I feel like I've been waiting for this for a while as well. So Alan, I think your experience is a lot different.
Very.
Yeah. So what was your,
It's been a pretty busy year. And so I had heard about the book a long time ago, and I have a secret love affair to move to Japan and be a missionary. So, there's just an attractive place in my heart for the nation, but I knew of Endo's book, but I honestly thought this was like a Liam Neeson action flick. So it never registered with me until later, even after I'd seen the movie, that was about the book. You know, I kept thinking, this is so familiar. What is this? What is this? So I went in thinking we're going to see Liam Neeson, you know, take on some Eastern European mob. I hadn't even watched a trailer or anything. So I was absolutely stunned walking out of the movie.
Yeah, I remember it was after a service, a couple of friends from church were like, "Hey, we're going to go see Silence because we've got to see this movie." And I said, "Alan would love this film." Or at least, you know, I assume so based on everything that I knew about the film. And I think you were just excited that someone invited you to go see a movie.
Exactly.
And that you were free to do it.
Right.
Because I think we went on Saturday, Martin Luther King.
Oh, no, it was like a holiday day.
Yeah, it was on Martin Luther King Day.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, he's actually free. Let's invite him. And
yeah, so I'd known about the book from a long time ago, and did not register that the book was the movie. Go to the movie. I'm absolutely floored. And the whole time I kept thinking, there's deja vu going on about this movie. I know it. So then I went home and Googled it, and instantly the flood of all these memories had come back. So the second time watching it was actually even better than mm-hmm. the first for me, because I had that expectation geared up going into the second one with, you know, I was certainly, I thought, again, it was like bait and switch. I thought it was a Liam Neeson movie. He was irrelevant almost. I mean, except for the power of his character and the role that he played of converting.
Yeah, but he wasn't, you know, like, he's like lead billing. He was, you know, he's not there.
A bit part almost. Yeah. So I think my experience was much different. I just felt like an idiot afterwards of how did I not register in my brain that that was the movie on the book and all that. So,
well, and see that, so that's very interesting to me. And, like, I know your engagement with it and your thoughtfulness after the film is, one of the reasons that I wanted you on the podcast anyway, because, I don't think you necessarily have to know a lot going into a film. It's like, what does the film stir up in you afterwards? Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I really love this idea that people aren't going to know a whole lot about this film.
Uh-uh.
It's, I mean, there are a plenty of articles. I'm trying to figure out if I'm going to put any in the show notes, but there's a lot of articles about lots of the hurdles that Scorsese had to do just to get this film made. And then after it was made, the kind of like the suing and the lawsuits and the zero marketing that it basically had, especially compared, you know, like if Scorsese makes a film, people are going to market the crap out of it.
Right. Absolutely.
Even if it's like super, like I remember like seeing commercials on network television for The Wolf of Wall Street.
Yeah.
Like a movie that in no way will ever get played on network television, or it'll be like 20 minutes long.
Right.
So even a movie like that is getting, you know, lots of marketing, whether it does well or not, whether people actually end up going seeing it, whatever. Like this, except for people in the film and theology circles, almost no one I knew really knew that Silence was coming out.
Yeah.
And if they did, they were like, oh yeah, I think you mentioned that before, or maybe you mentioned it, or maybe I read about it like in the most anticipated films of whatever year at realworldtheology.com.
Right.
You know, like, so something like that. So, it's awesome to see that you had people that loved you enough to let you, to invite you to this film.
And I just want to sit and talk afterwards, but I had to bolt on.
You know? Everyone did. That was the thing. Like, and I think there was, I think it was maybe during the Fuller's interview or sit down and Q&A with Scorsese that it was Scorsese or somebody else who said, like, this movie was meant to be seen in a time, like, not going by yourself.
Right.
You have to go with a friend or go with a group.
Yeah.
And then you need to have time to sit and think about it for, you know, quite some time afterwards.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think the joke was even, you know, for a couple hours or a couple months.
Oh,
you
easily.
Know, just kind of wrestle with it.
Yeah.
And, you know, which, like I said, is crazy to me. Obviously, it was on my radar. It was something that I knew Scorsese was making. I hadn't read the book, but everyone I knew, my wife read the book, and she was like, I don't know how they're going to make this a movie because I don't know if I can watch it.
Mm.
She's like, I love this book. Like, this book was affecting.
Yeah.
She said it was, she was like, you know, I would walk in and she'd be like crying, like reading this book. And I was like, I should read that book. But then that's what I say about almost every book, but I'm too busy watching movies. So
right.
That's, you know, my kind of pretend get out of jail free card. I'm too busy watching movies to talk about them. And so I really wanted to do it, but didn't get to do it. Everyone that I knew who had read this book said it was incredible. Mm-hmm. And they were losing their minds because this was getting made into a movie. And then they were losing their minds a second time over because Scorsese was doing it. And, you know, obviously Scorsese, one of the greatest filmmakers, of all time. So, now that we kind of know where we were coming from, I'm curious to get us to get us kind of started in that direction, Joel, how would you say this movie affected you in your faith? Mm. Like on a personal level, like what kind of things did it make you think about, or when you paused in your own silence? And actually, I'm curious, you know, if there was a difference between your engagement with the book versus your engagement with the movie. Just kind of, you know, how did it hit you?
Yeah, I think reading the book for the first time was one of those formative shaping experiences of my life in terms of my faith, and helping me understand both a bit more of Christian history. It was something that I had, even though it's a fictional account, it's based on actual things that happened with the Jesuits and with the nation of Japan. And so I think it was eye-opening for me, who had grown up in a fairly conservative, I'll say ahistorical church background, where it's kind of like, this is just my church and we love Jesus and that's what we do. To recognize that, oh, there's other people around the world who love Jesus or don't love Jesus, and the way that their faith is shaped and challenged over time, like, is different. And so I think reading the book was incredibly eye-opening for me in terms of what that history was like for Christianity in Japan. But watching the film, I think I was struck more, it's hard to say, just the way that it's paced and the way that it raises these difficult questions about faith. I think I was struck with God's patience. Mm-hmm. And the nature of patience when it comes to faith, what it means to wait and not always get an answer, and yet to still cling to hope and cling to faith, and how difficult doing the right thing really is. I think in a culture right now where it sometimes is difficult to know whether we're doing the right thing or the wrong thing, and the question of, are we on the right side of history or the wrong side of history with the particular decisions that we make, either mm-hmm. personally or like as a society?
Yeah.
This is the kind of film that raises those questions and doesn't really give a clear answer. And it's, I don't know. It's difficult to answer that question because I think I'm still in the process. I think mm-hmm. I've been wondering about how this is shaping me and, what I bring to the film, and how two different viewings of the film shaped me as well. I think the second time, knowing how it was going to end, mm-hmm. made things different for me. And I imagine we'll talk about that ending in the context of this podcast, because we're a spoiler-ish podcast, correct?
That's, oh, yes. Okay. Yes.
So,
yeah, if people don't know by now.
Totally.
Yeah, we are going to talk about
that ship sailed.
Yeah, we're going to talk about the film in its full. So if you haven't seen Silence, I think the story is powerful enough, not to completely derail your train of thought, Joel, but I think the film is powerful enough that even if you know what happens, you might lose some of the tension, but you don't lose any of the the questions, the thematics, the power of the actual film doesn't diminish.
Right. The end to me was actually irrelevant to the story.
Yeah.
Mm. That's interesting to hear. Cause mm-hmm. So the book itself is a bit more ambiguous, actually mm-hmm. a lot more ambiguous when it comes to the ending and what, mm-hmm. How things play out. And Scorsese kind of makes a point at the end, and he closes the film with a really powerful image that seems to be faith affirming. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, leaving the film going, that was a genuinely well-made faith affirming film, was both powerful in that, just because of what it is, because I don't know how else to put it besides it has a positive spin on faith and Christianity while still showing the dark side of this reality in history.
Mm. Yeah.
And yet, like, I didn't leave going, you know, like all my answers or all my questions have been answered and everything is wrapped up nice and neat at the end. There's still so many questions that it raises about mission work and about, about the nature of faith. Like, what is true belief? Is faith defined by my actions? Is defined by my words? How does the community of faith that I'm a part of, how is the gospel that has been handed to me by somebody else at some point actually help me understand who God is? And is it the true gospel or not? What does it mean for the good news to be both culturally shaped, but then somehow timeless? All those kinds of questions were raised for me. And those aren't necessarily questions I've never asked before, but the film brings them to the forefront in such a way that you can't help but wrestle with them, and maybe wrestle with them afresh because of the care for the characters that you see and recognizing yourself in those particular characters. So I think the first time I saw the film, I strongly identified with Father Rodriguez, with Andrew Garfield's character, and kind of saw myself in him. And maybe that's because he's the central character. Maybe that's because of just where I was at in that particular moment. I think there's a part of me having a pastoral background that I see myself in those kind of clergy roles. But the second time I watched the film, and I think this is key, like I strongly identified with Kichichiro, and found myself far more drawn to him and really now see him as the kind of the moral and spiritual heart of the film, more than Rodriguez. And where I was a bit more critical of Kichichiro the first viewing, I was more critical of Rodriguez the second viewing and could see both sides of their relationship and just how that grew and developed over the course of the film. So it's the kind of film that each viewing I imagine would bring different interpretations and results and draw new images or new ideas into one's mind, just depending on where they're at. It's kind of like a faith barometer, I suppose, in some ways, like it's bringing out, this is kind of where you're at right now.
Depending on what you connect with.
Yeah. I don't know if that makes sense, but it raised questions that I think were, had I seen this film 5 years ago, I think would have been different questions. But because of who I am now, this is the way that I saw it.
Well, I think that's a signature of a really well-made film, because I don't want to say that this is Bible-level storytelling, but what you're describing it is what I hear so many people talking about when they're like, the Bible, the living word, you know, it's new every day. Like when I read this passage when I was 10, it was like, oh yes, this thing, I understand everything about this passage. But then I read that passage when I'm 30 and I'm like, I didn't even know. And I feel like, you know, scripture can be a barometer as well to tell. You know, just sit in a small group with people and read like two or three verses and then sit around and like have everyone say what they're thinking, and you'll find exactly like where their heart is or what they're either struggling with or what they're thinking through. And the other thing that I really liked that you said was that to criticize some things, this isn't like a faith-based Christian film. You know, there are no bows. People don't go to a Newsboys concert at the end. you know, and everything's not great when that one atheist friend finally believes in Jesus.
Right.
Like that's not happening in this film. Like none of the characters are two dimensional. The, you know, the good guys who are sometimes good guys and sometimes bad guys, like every, it was so refreshing and painful to see characters that were so real, even when they were barely there. Like, I was like, this is just almost like a masterstroke to be able to have a character who comes in for like, and he's only on the screen for maybe 1 to 2 minutes, and I completely care about everything that he or she is doing.
Right.
And I feel like there are almost no wasted characters in this film. And it's just completely affecting, because like I said, like, or like you said, Joel, there's not a whole lot of answers. Mm. And I think that's, while I'm not in any way arguing against absolute truth, I think there are lots of very black and white truths about our faith, but I also think there's a ton of gray. Mm. And I think it's very hard to make a compelling film about the black and whites. Mm. When, especially if you're going to make a really affecting,
right,
Christian, I can't see the quote marks, but, you know, kind of Christian, mm-hmm, film, or at least a film about faith, and Silence does that. Mm. So, Alan,
yeah,
I want to know what was racing through your mind after you saw this film, besides Liam Neeson didn't have a gun the entire time.
Yeah, he didn't take on half of Eastern Europe.
Yeah.
So I would say that what kept building for me and was the climax of Garfield's apostasy,
mm-hmm,
Rodriguez, is constantly questioning, what would I do if I was in that situation? So that film really drew me in and put me in his shoes. And would I have made the same decision?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a troubling decision.
Mm-hmm.
It's not as black and white as I think it could be pigeonholed to be.
Well, and the church has a long history of, you know, lifting up the martyrs, you know, right. There's almost like a martyr worship.
Yeah.
Like that Christianity historically has.
Right.
So if you would say that you wouldn't do that, I mean,
you're selling things short. So yeah, I think his reason for not doing that was the right, you know, I'm skipping ahead.
That
really shook me. Like, what would I have done, had I been in that situation? So I was troubled by that. The second time, I was actually really angry at Chichiro.
Mm.
I was really mad at him. And I don't know why I'm mad at him, but I left like, not even with pity or sadness, like, what a total sellout. And which is why I think my anger probably stems from, would I have been like him as well?
Mm.
So I'm vacillating between, would I be and do what Rodriguez did or Kichichiro, you know? So there was a lot just banging through my head as I watched the same film twice with different experiences of it.
And so you're saying that you just couldn't stand Kichichiro the second time because you're just looking at Alan Hawkins.
Yeah, and you know, putting myself in his shoes, I can see why he did what he did. It was constantly skirting the cost,
mm-hmm,
of his faith, and yet wanting to be in the faith. And so it was the route of shortcuts. Where I would say Rodriguez's character, his decision was actually the most painful one for him. He took on the greatest deal of suffering because his faith was so important to him. It was everything to him. And for him to quote unquote deny it was actually such a cost,
mm-hmm,
you know. So those were the things that were rattling through my brain as I watched the movie, and felt like I watched the same movie, the same but two different movies.
Mm-hmm. So I assumed this would come up at some point, so I'm not hesitant to jump in. Though I thought it would make much better of a climax to the episode of us having to put it out on Front Street. But so I'll just plainly, as best you can, Alan, like I know you're like, I feel like you're skirting around it. I want to give you the freedom to dive in.
Say it.
So everyone's question when I talked to him about this movie, like, did Rodriguez make the right decision?
I feel like I want to jump up and imitate Jack Nicholson and say, "You're darn right. I ordered the code red." You know, I absolutely believe he made the right decision, and I do that for a number of reasons, but I do so with fear and trepidation because the martyr is the exalted path in history. You know, will I remain faithful even if it's on the line? And I think he kept his faith. Absolutely convinced he kept his faith. But to deny, to apostatize, so to speak, was a tremendous act of compassion for the Japanese people. And it's interesting how he looked on them with such pity, the wretched ones, and the, you know, and yet he was willing to give up the most important thing for him, which was his faith, in order that they would be rescued and delivered from suffering.
So that's tough.
Yeah.
Because when you describe it that way, I don't just suppose, but there are numerous reviews. Like I said, it depends on kind of where you are theologically, or where the reviewer is theologically, that would say it's, you're describing it as a, one of the most compassionate things that you can do to end their suffering, to give up your faith, but it,
to give up the outward expression.
The outward expression. Okay, yeah. So that's more of a clarifying statement.
Which, you know, again, the situation with his wife holding the cross, the symbol, led me to believe they kept the faith. Or, not only that they kept it, that he probably transmitted his faith to her.
So if he wouldn't have, if we would have only seen as much of Rodriguez as we saw of Ferreira,
I'd have a different conclusion.
You'd probably have a different conclusion. Yeah.
I think Ferreira sold out in that sense. Yeah.
And but, I guess that's why, like, it's hard for me to know how to answer that question of did Rodriguez do the right thing? Because it's one thing if he personally gives up his faith or the appearance of his faith.
Yeah.
But in joining Ferreira, who feels like kind of a tempter type of character here, like a temptation in the wilderness sort of moment. So yeah, Ferreira is Satan, I guess, is what I'm saying. Like, to join in and be a companion to that, because it's not just that he like abandons public sense, but then he becomes actively opposed to Christianity in Japan, right? Like, he is helping write literature against his own faith system and trying to discourage the spreading of that faith. And it seemed like, even to the point where at least one of those Dutch traders who's trying to sneak some sort of Christian relic into Japan is going to end up killed or punished in some way when they find those relics by searching them out. And so it's hard to answer that question because putting myself in that situation, could I do that? It's one thing to say, yeah, I don't believe in Jesus anymore, but it would be another thing for me to publicly write books on why Jesus isn't real and why you should not believe him. That might cause other people to give up their faith. Or at least be a discouragement to Christianity.
So I think I felt like the argument, and again, if this is something the book maybe clarifies more, then I did just honestly miss it. But the understanding that I had was when it seemed like the Japanese were satisfied having basically the last priest in Japan apostatize. And it's not like they stopped persecuting Christians, but they did not act it, like they just kind of let it alone, assuming it would die out, I guess. And his appearance of actively working against Christianity goes hand in hand with him also allowing Christianity to thrive in another state. A state without him.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of saying that they didn't need him. Or, you know, God didn't necessarily need him to be the person to allow Christianity to survive in Japan. Which I think goes to one of the arguments against his decision. No, it's pro his decision, mm-hmm. because the reason that he would have done it was because he finally comes to the idea that he was less worshiping Christ or less worshiping God and more worshiping his own pride in himself as a savior. You know, we see him looking into the river and liking him, imagining himself basically as a European Christ figure.
Right.
There on the first watch through, I was moved to tears on lots of the imagery that we saw of Rodriguez in Christ-like situations, mm-hmm. like riding on like a, you know, a mule or a donkey,
yeah.
having people like spit on him and curse at him. And
through the town.
And you know, the Inquisitor's like, so these are the people that, you know, you're here to save, you know, like, mm-hmm. look at them. Like, why would you want to give yourself for these right. people? And I'm like starting to weep because I'm like, this is such a beautiful image of Christ-like what Christ scene. Is.
Yeah.
And it's when he finally comes up against, Ferreira in the cage, on the night that he apostatizes, and Ferreira, I do feel like it's like his in the desert moment,
mm-hmm.
and Ferreira is doing the best tempter,
yeah,
because he's saying all the right things that are just skewed, mm-hmm. slightly off,
mm-hmm.
Because he, I think he's right. I think he accuses Rodriguez of. I wish I had the line, but it was something like, are you so arrogant that you think you're Christ, basically, that you would put yourself on the same level as Christ? You think your suffering is, you know, on par,
mm-hmm.
with the Son of God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's how you see yourself. Do you not see your sin?
Right.
And I think he is 100% right about that.
Yeah, I do too. I actually think Rodriguez's denial was his salvation.
So I think for Rodriguez, because I'm kind of with Joel on this too. Like I think.
Oh, you're playing both sides.
I am exactly great. Playing both sides. Because I think that's the thing.
And I guess I don't want to say that like I don't think he made the right decision because it's just hard for me to even answer yes or no.
Yeah.
And that's what I think it's supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
Is there times when I'm like, absolutely. Like, I think that was the best. And there's a faith element to that, to be honest. Like, even in, he eventually chooses to do this because he envisions the face of Christ. Mm-hmm. And that God stops being silent for one time in the movie and speaks. Mm-hmm. Which yeah. is so
powerful
yeah. and so important. And when that happened, that was a moment I was moved of this is God speaking and coming out of the silence and the things that God says, the way that Christ speaks to him, even though it misses one of the key lines from the book, that talks about how I came to be trampled on is what Jesus says in the mm-hmm. book, something to those of, to that effect, which is just a remarkable thing to say, mm-hmm. but, In this moment of hearing Christ's voice, there is something about I totally agree with Alan that the denial is the salvation, which is such a paradox.
Yeah, exactly.
And makes little sense that by giving up Jesus, you gain Jesus. by choosing to step on the face of Christ and give up everything that you'd ever known is how you actually encounter Christ.
Yeah.
But I think that that's a... that kind of spirituality, Martin Luther has this idea of the theology of the cross, that we encounter God only through the cross and through suffering and through this ultimate emptiness, that it's not in this theology of glory and all the amazing things and blessings that we could accomplish or achieve or find, but it's in the brokenness and in the suffering in the world that we find that God is there. And when we come to the end of ourselves, the complete end of ourselves, that's when we truly encounter Christ, because it's not about us at all anymore. Yeah. And I think that that moment in the film is a great depiction of what that theology of the cross really looks like, and yet how terrifying that is. So it's hard again to say, is this the right thing to do? I think it is, but it's also, it's not the easy thing to do, and it's still messy and has consequences.
And it's, I think, a little nuanced. I think it was the right thing for Rodriguez to do. And that was...
like at that moment.
At that moment, and who he was, and really his persona of, I am a Messiah. So think of the irony. He went to Japan to save Ferreira, and he could not save Ferreira, and how disappointed he was, and a little bit sanctimonious to Ferreira sitting outside, you know, at the temple.
Yeah.
And so his whole mission of salvation was not the Japanese people. It was Ferreira. And for him to deny his faith, so to speak, was so the people would be saved for the first time, you know? So there was a lot, I picked up on some irony and of his quote unquote apostasy, where I just don't think it was even apostasy.
Well, I like how you're basically answering what was my next question, and I'd love for you to take it the next step, because it means we're kind of going in a direction that I was hoping we'd go. So it's nothing to apologize for, but I was basically wondering, is it possible to apostatize and still be in the Lord's will? You know, because I feel like the movie seems to say, yeah, sure. Like, basically anything's possible. I think it goes back a little bit to the questions that, Joel, you said you were wrestling with. Like, you know, like, what is most important in our faith? You know, is it the grace that we have faith at all? Is it the words we say? Is it the works we do? You know, because all these things are mentioned in multiple places in the Bible as all being important.
Yeah. And is Rodriguez, is he still a Christian? Is he still quote unquote saved? Is he part of that? And then the question is raised too, is Kichichiro still a Christian? Is he still saved even in all the different times that he gives up the faith, you know, like, and seems pretty quick to do that and yet also can't give up the faith. Like, right. he keeps coming back
and
asking for confession and continues to seek the Lord, and ultimately is dragged away, right? Like, he again finds something that he's held on to, and they drag him away, and we're not really sure what ends up happening to him. So maybe he becomes a Christian martyr in that regard. I don't know, but
well, I love the tempter in the desert again, even Ferreira's words questioning, not just like, is Rodriguez a Christian, is Kichichiro a Christian, but like, he comes in and says, are the Japanese Christians even Christians?
Yeah.
You know, like, he basically has to say, like, what makes these people Christian?
What's real?
And why are you holding on to it?
Yeah.
Like, is this the true faith or not? And how would you know? Is it because people held on to crosses and said the right words and did the right thing? And there's, so it just depends. It's a question about, you know, one's theology regarding salvation, I suppose.
Yeah.
What that all entails. Like, if you're on our more reformed tradition of once saved, always saved, and it's all up to God anyway, and God just elects who he's going to pick, and that's the deal.
What was the last Calvin cinema letter, dear?
Yeah, like apostatizing or whatever, it doesn't really... It's kind of like, well, you could try to do that all you want, but you're still locked firm in God's grip. But if your theology is open to that, of this idea that I either would lose one salvation or never really had it in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is ultimately a question that comes back to God, right? Like, God gets to determine that, thankfully. I don't, and none of us do. But it does raise those really practical questions of what does one's lifestyle and behavior and ethic, and how does that relate to one's faith and whether that faith is true or not.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard because there are things in my own life where I look back on things I've said and done and believed, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, and I'm like, that's ridiculous. And I thought it was deeply Christian.
Mm-hmm.
Like, all Christians are Republicans was something I grew up believing.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't, those were equated in my mind, right?
Right.
And the idea of, like, voting otherwise or believing otherwise was, in essence, like giving up the faith.
Apostasy.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And then, you know, becoming a voting age and meeting other people and moving around a bunch and
living in the Pacific my Northwest. Own,
yeah, exactly. Living in hyper-liberal Portland, Oregon. I know lots of Christians who aren't Republicans. I also still know lots of Christians who are Republicans, too. And recognizing that faith is far more nuanced than that. So all that to say is, can you give up your faith and then still be a part of this? In the context of the movie, it seems like that. And I think I love that Christianity is portrayed as the kind of faith where a Rodriguez and a Cachichiro can both be reconciled to one another,
mm-hmm.
and be considered Christian brothers by the end.
Yeah.
That this is the kind of faith and religion and spirituality that a person as just low as Cachichiro, the kind of character that he has, can still be embraced and find forgiveness and grace is, I think, a pretty remarkable testimony to the power of the Christian faith. He is a disgusting character in so many ways, and yet he is me. Like, I'm Cachichiro.
I've done
that. If not, I mean, no, I haven't, like, let my family get burned to death on a beach or something like that. But thank God.
Clarification.
Disclaimer.
I have, at multiple points in my life, been like, honestly, every time I sin, actively or passively, I'm choosing to say I buy into this, my own personal decision and behavior and belief, more than I think that God's plan for my life is better.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just going to kind of do my own thing right now to save my own skin. And I do that frequently.
Yeah.
And yet God still continues to embrace me as his beloved and continues to embrace Cachichiro. And I think that is a beautiful testimony to faith and to Christian belief and to the grace that we can find in Jesus.
And I think that grace is what I saw missing from so many reviews.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I feel like you could fall... Again, I feel like there... It was pitted as if there were two camps, which I think was the biggest error in the discussion of this film after the fact. There was either like Team Grace, like Team Full Grace, apostatize all you want, whatever, grace, and I want to be Team Grace, but then there was the other side, which is like, you know, we're told that, like, you don't deny the faith. Like, it is one of the highest virtues to call the name of Christ regardless of circumstance, regardless of the, like, understanding that there is a big difference between circumstance and salvation. Mm. And I am completely on board with that. I mean, like, I think that's the reason the martyrs are, through Christian history, lauded to the point where they are, because I think it takes a great deal of faith to say, this life is not it.
Right.
And I just feel like that answer's got to be somewhere there in the middle, because, like, we see so many instances of repetitive grace in the Bible, and I think it just keeps reminding me of Joel. You continually coming back to Kichichiro, because, you know, when we see the film, we're like Rodriguez, we're not like Kichichiro. Like, when I read the Bible, I'm like, yeah, I do lots of things like Jesus does, but in essence, I'm Peter. You know, I'm denying Christ three times. You know,
I think. Maybe I saw it a little differently. I think that, and I picked this up in the reviews too, and other people's opinions. I just don't think Rodriguez apostatized, because I don't think he denied his faith to save his own hide.
Well, you think he always kept his faith? He may have said words.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so
let me... So I think he denied his faith to save people's lives.
So in a
he denied his public expression of his faith.
Yes. So in a movie year that saw us have that movie that I don't feel that bad for not remembering the title of it, but it was about the Rachel, the girl that didn't deny her faith at Columbine. So you know, that's the expectation.
Right.
Like, you die. You don't deny for any reason, even to save your own skin, even to save the person next to you, nothing. Like, that is the movie that people are going to be like, oh, that's what Christianity is.
Yeah.
Can you point to something in the Bible that says it's kind of okay to have, like, a secret faith? Like, do we have a leg to stand on?
That's why I say he did the right thing with great fear and trepidation that my colleagues are going to listen to this podcast. Again, that's you're getting into the famous Kantian situational ethics, you know. I think he denied his public expression of his faith to save people's lives, who didn't probably understand what they were doing. I think that became his conclusion. And they were staying strong because he was staying strong, not because they were actually believing.
Like, they weren't staying strong because of their faith in God.
Right.
They were staying strong because
their faith in him.
Faith in him. Mm.
So, and I think that became clear in his interaction with Ferreira. So when he denied his faith, the public expression of it, that was not to save his own hide. He was not afraid to die.
Mm-hmm.
He was willing to be a martyr. I mean, he was willing to be a martyr by virtue of the fact that he went to Japan under the risk of dying. No one wants to die, but I think he was willing to die for his faith. So that's why I just couldn't call what he did apostasy, in that classic sense of it's the Roman, I'm supposed to sacrifice to Caesar, and if I don't sacrifice to Caesar, I'm eaten by the lions. He would have gladly gone to the grave, but he knew they were not going to kill him. They were going to pit him against the Japanese Christians and use him as a manipulative tool against them. So that's why I didn't see it as apostasy in the classic sense.
So would you say that Kichichiro ever apostatized?
Yeah, and maybe that's why I felt such... disdain for him, and especially his witness of Rodriguez and his interactions with him. And even when he saw Rodriguez do what he did to deny his faith, to save lives, he was still interested in saving his own hide. So that's probably why his character really became, it wasn't a matter of is he in grace or not. It was just that lack of, or that he was out to save himself above everyone, but he recognized his weakness. Yeah. So.
Well, and I would say, I'm guessing, and y'all are welcome to correct me, but I'm guessing that even apostasy can be, I guess, grace can cover apostasy. There can be forgiveness. There can be like a turning, because you're saying, you know, Kichijiro was actually apostatizing, yeah, but he was welcomed back into the faith each time. Theologically, we don't have a problem with that.
Well, probably because I come from a Reformed background, so I don't think you lose your faith per se. I don't think what can separate us from the love of God? Nothing. Even if we deny him, even Timothy says, even if we deny him, he will deny us, which is, I interpret and understand to be our experience of his presence near to us. But it says, when we are faithless, he is faithful. So I just don't think you lose your salvation through apostasy. And even knowing enough about church history, the battle after the Roman persecutions, and had once they ended, the church's argument wasn't, were these people saved? It's, how do we restore them when some people stayed strong and they did not? And how do we keep them in communion and in fellowship when half these people are walking around without their arms because of their faith, and these other folks, you know, denied Christ or sacrificed to Caesar to save their own hide? And the church had concluded they need a period of restoration to bring them back into the fold of the church, but their salvation wasn't questioned. And I think that's a helpful perspective about apostasy.
That's a hard one, though.
Yeah,
it's always hard.
Yeah. You suffered, you lost your family on the account of your faith, and the guy next to you didn't, and he gets to come to the communion table with you.
Yeah.
So I think the early church wisely said they have to be brought back in through a period of restoration. It was never a question about their salvation. It was about the unity of the church.
And that's very interesting, because there's so many conversations that I have, even one that I had very recently with an acquaintance on Facebook, because someone went out there's like, is there anything that God can't forgive? And this guy said, you know, a couple of people said, oh, you know, like the Holy Spirit, kind of like
right.
the
blasphemy.
I would say, yeah, the blasphemy, and that would be the go-to. But there was one guy who said, basically, no, there's nothing that can't be forgiven as long as you are truly sorry and don't ever do it again. And I said, question.
Who is ever truly, truly sorry for what they've done?
And I said, okay, so say I'm truly sorry, but like, I never do it again. And so we got into all these conversations about like, well, what is sin? I mean, like you're basically saying like, hey, I robbed a store. I will never rob that store again. Yeah. I'm saying like, you got angry at your wife.
Right.
Like, you can't promise me you will never get angry at your wife again, you know? And he's like,
it's being selfish, where it's more of an internal, you know, less of an external behavior and more of this internal attitude or posture. It's pretty hard to say.
Yeah.
Like, I'm 100%, I'm never going to be prideful again.
I'm done.
That's a very prideful statement. Actually.
Exactly. Well, it's just the truth.
Right.
You're denying the truth.
Right. Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's the hardest thing. So, you know, I'm having conversations, like I said, with this guy, kind of bringing up one of the most beautiful things that I'd ever heard, which is when Tim Keller kind of goes through the story of the prodigal son, and, you know, he goes through all the nuances of it, things that blew my mind on all kinds of levels. And then at the very end, he goes, and the most beautiful thing is if the younger brother went to the father and said, I want to leave again, the father would give him half of everything again, and he would leave. And then when he came running back, he would run to him again and again
right.
and again.
Yeah.
Even if he kept making the same mistake, right. even if he kept wanting to be whatever. And I'm sitting there trying to tell this guy, and he's like, I don't think that's the way it works. He's like, you can't just keep getting it over and over and over again, which again goes back to the reviews that I saw, which were like, yeah. you blew it. And you know, and I think, like I said, I think they have a lot of good points, because I think denying your faith in public is a very serious thing.
Yeah.
And I think it should not be taken lightly, and I think it should not be praised or, you know, applauded.
Right.
Even in the best of circumstances. Mm. But at the same time, I think you have to have a view of God and a view of grace that is big enough to cover that.
Yeah.
Because I think we see it in the Bible too many times. Because I think it becomes pride. It's like, well, I wouldn't mess up that many times.
Right.
So I don't see why, you know, maybe I mess up once.
Right.
You know, but I mean, like twice. Who's selfish twice?
Right. Yeah.
I mean, not Joel.
Right.
No. But.
Definitely not me. No, I think it's a good question to raise, because it's difficult. And mm-hmm. so I'm coming from, I guess, less of a Reformed tradition. And so there is a part of me that wants to say,
he's out.
He's done. Well,
or that actions matter, that they do have consequences, and mm-hmm. that personal decisions, that when we choose to reject God, that there is some sort of ramification for that.
Yeah.
But I do think that there's that question that has to be raised of, like, what does rejecting God mean? And is this person's story over yet?
Right.
No, so like with Kichichiro, what does that entail? What, it's back and forth and back and forth, and what does his story ultimately hold, and how does that story conclude in his life? And we don't know for Kichichiro, but we do know for Rodriguez, and get to see like a literal picture of what that enduring faith was for him.
Yeah,
in the context of the film,
and yet at the same time, when he's discovered, he claims he got the relic from gambling with Dutchman, you know, that yeah. it wasn't something he knew about or willfully chose to get or to hide. It was accidental. So that's probably why I just became more and more, you know, disgust is probably too strong a word, just disappointed in him, yeah. but loving the wrestle you have with his character, mm-hmm. you know, like, is he a recipient of grace? Absolutely. You know, is he a bonehead? Absolutely. And the beauty of that was really remarkable to watch for me, especially the second time I watched the movie.
That's why, like, it's hard to know, to take this out of the context of the movie and more into like these real life applications. Mm-hmm. What are those actions or behaviors that could somehow drive somebody outside of God's grace? And the big theological answer would just be nothing. Jesus can, what he's done on the cross and through his death and resurrection can cover that. But there is something about, well, then does that mean our actions just don't matter? That our decisions don't matter? That I can vote however I want, and mm-hmm. that can be determined as, doesn't really affect my faith or how other people perceive Jesus, or I can say or do whatever I want on social media or with other people. And, well, it's all grace anyway. Like, I'm just a sinner saved by grace, and that's okay. Or are there, can justice be called upon for some of these decisions that we make? And
right.
those questions of ethics. And I think you raised that earlier, Alan, like, what's a personal ethic, and then how does this affect our public ethics and social ethics when it comes to these decisions? Can my faith just be a personalized private matter, or is it inherently public, the way that I act and behave in the world, particularly when my faith is called into question and I'm put on a stand to determine whether or not I'm a Christian. I don't have good answers to all these things that I'm raising, but I think the film, that's why the film is so effective, in that it raises that and asks these questions about what do I really believe when it comes to other people's behavior and my own behavior?
Right.
And whether they say, and on the flip side too, like they say they're a Christian and yet act in a non-Christian behavior or decidedly un-Christian behavior. Do I believe what they say on the outside? You know, like using their words, especially if other later words are very different from that.
Yeah.
Well,
it's probably why the second time I watched the movie, my admiration for Rodriguez really grew. And here's the way I encountered it. So the difference between him and Ferreira was Ferreira really acclimated and capitulated to his culture. He became interested in learning more about the faith of the culture, and he was conversant in it and even respected for that. Whereas Rodriguez never gave off the vibe, I'm really glad to be doing this. He did not give off a rebellious vibe, but he was not jovial. He was not light. It was almost like he was giving off disdain without being disdainful. And the fact that his spouse had the cross, I just had to wonder, where did she pick that up? Mm. And did she interpret his faith as so real because she knew the inside, that it made her attracted to Jesus? And did the warlord, you know, did he also really respect Rodriguez, even though he knew he had him under his foot? So that's what really was remarkable to me about his decision. It was not a decision to apostatize. It was actually the strongest decision of faith.
You raised something too that I actually found a little frustrating about Rodriguez, at least the earlier parts of the film, and I suppose in the later part too, is his seeming inability or lack of desire to really understand or connect with Japanese culture, and where Ferreira kind of goes too far into the deep end of saying this culture is essentially superior, and I'm buying in wholeheartedly, including these beliefs when it comes to religion. Rodriguez and Grupe, when they first show up, kind of show up, you know, and hold on to their European colonial ways.
Right,
and
really,
you know, try to understand. It's really interesting watching this and having done, you know, missions and done research on missiology and things like that, to see these guys just kind of come in and almost right away start telling people what to do and what the right thing is. And you all need to go talk to the other villagers and meet with them without really understanding where they're coming from, where the Japanese Christians are coming from, and choosing to listen and choosing to try and understand and embrace that culture. And so when you were talking about that, Alan, were you saying that Rodriguez at the end, when after he has stepped on the image of Christ that and has a Japanese wife and is acclimated to the culture, that he doesn't seem to enjoy that? Or
no, not the wife, but it's almost like has this silent, rebellious disdain. You know,
just writing up my apostasy letter again.
Right. Like I'm letting
he
you know that I hate this, but I'm not going to publicly say I hate it, because you will then put me under the gun and punish people for this. Mm. But I'm letting you know that I still believe. So that was the difference, the contrast between him and Ferreira, I think, where Ferreira really gave up the goods.
Yeah, totally.
So I want to kind of change gears a little bit.
Yeah.
Because I really do think the conversations around Rodriguez's decision and all the inner workings of the interactions with Kichichiro, I mean, the Facebook discussions alone so far have gone, 100 comments or so, it can go around in circle. But I actually was curious, before we have to wind down, to kind of shift to just the ideas the film deals with outside of what the characters are specifically dealing with, because I think the film itself being, or the book being called Silence, the film, obviously being named Silence, and then we have the lines in the film about the silence of God. I think that hits me deeply, because often, you sit there and you pray and you're like, God, just tell me what you want me to do. Mm-hmm. Just show up, just do this thing. And so many times, like, we can look around the world. One of the biggest stones that atheists throw are kind of like, where is God in this? Where is God in that? Mm. And there's just silence. Mm. And so I'm curious, both of you have been tasked to pastor on some level. I'll say on some level. You're being tasked to pastor. There's no some level to it. Mm-hmm. You've been tasked to pastor. So if someone comes to you and they're struggling because they say, all I hear from God is silence, like, what can we possibly tell them?
Hmm. So I had, it was at least a 2-hour conversation with a person about 2 weeks ago, and they have tried to keep the faith, they've prided themselves on, I've believed and I've tried to be strong, and their life is absolutely falling apart.
Mm-hmm.
Economically, the health of their parents, all this stuff. And the person was asking me, where is God in this? And I felt like the only thing I could answer her on was, you look at the cross. Like, that's the answer. That's God's answer to the suffering and the pain. And so this film to me was very cross-centric, in that sense that it didn't give that up. And so that's probably the answer I would say is, it's not that God is silent. It's that he's actually made a huge statement, and the statement is the cross. A God who's willing to suffer for us. That's his answer. And that might not satisfy us,
mm-hmm.
At a surface level, but I think in the long run, it is the only answer that will satisfy us.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, coming back to that idea of the theology of the cross, that we find God and see God most clearly in what he's done for us on the cross, mm-hmm. and through his resurrection, and that Christ entered into our world. And I think the film, it is a very cross-centric film. The image of crosses, I noticed it the first time, but the second time in particular, it just comes up over and over again. And mm-hmm. From the scene in the crucifixion in the ocean to handing these little crosses to different people, it's just a very cruciform.
Even in his house.
Yes.
When you panned up on the wall and the drapes, the mm-hmm. curtains were hanging up, the thing holding them looked like a cross on its side, Yeah. It was just, I saw a lot of cross imagery all over the movie.
And it keeps pointing back to that, because I totally agree with Alan that in the midst of our suffering and in the midst of our pain, especially in those moments, I think God is there, and maybe most experienced there. But the idea that we have to that when good things are happening, then God is pleased, and that's when I'm experiencing God, or when I feel God the most. That's when God is around, is a decidedly, I think, Western modern American way of viewing spirituality and Christianity, and to recognize that much of Christian history has involved suffering. And that is also just a human life experience because of the reality of sin and brokenness in our world. Mm. And that the kind of God that we worship is the kind of God that enters into that broken and sinful world and bears that upon himself and enters into that, and then invites us to also, you know, to take up our cross, to follow him, to be, his followers in the midst of that, is not a fun or popular message to say as a pastor,
right.
But is still the theology of the cross, I think, can be deeply comforting when we don't have any other answer to give, because we have come to the end of ourselves.
Yeah.
And can only at the end just or groan or cry out and wait. And I think coming back to scripture, we see that over and over again in the Psalms, in the various stories, both Old and New Testament, of different people who've come to the end of themselves or wondered where God was, and had to wait or had to wonder.
Yeah.
And those stories remind us of God's faithfulness in the midst of that, because in the present suffering circumstance that I might be in, or a person might be in, it's hard to see that picture of God's faithfulness. And so I have to go back to, I'm part of this bigger story, and God has been faithful. Mm-hmm. And it's not that he's going to change right now with me, that he's going to continue to be faithful.
Yeah.
And that brings comfort. Mm-hmm. The story isn't over yet. And I just need to cling in faith to the God that enters into our world and dies on the cross for me, for creation.
Mm. I think that's a really good way of putting it. Like, God's not going to change, like, who he is fundamentally because of our situation or because of, you know.
Right.
Yeah, it's not like my particular moment or circumstance of suffering, or my moment, honestly, of doubt or struggle or the anger that I have in the midst of that is suddenly like God's going to go, well, I've pulled up by this. Like,
I didn't see that one coming.
I've been able to handle everything else, but I can't handle your pain or your frustration or your anger.
Mm-hmm. And not to belittle that pain or frustration or
right,
anger.
Right, no, it's real.
Absolutely. But to say that God does understand and does love and is there, mm-hmm. The God of Christianity is a God who is present in suffering and pain.
Yeah.
Incredibly present, and enters into that, even knowing resurrection on the far side of suffering, that he still does that, I think is a remarkable display of his love.
Yeah, I would just add one thing. I think his salvation, Rodriguez's salvation, was when he heard, I came to be trampled on, you know, like that's the theology of the cross right there.
Mm-hmm.
That confounds the wise and is foolishness to the Greeks and a stumbling block to the Jews. And that was probably the most powerful moment of the movie for me.
Absolutely.
Well, do you have more, Joel?
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, while I have you guys kind of in pseudo-pastor mode,
uh-oh.
I was going to, I'll preface that next one, or the next question with that idea in mind, because Tyler Huckabee wrote an article at the Washington Post that I thought was a pretty indicting and insightful work entitled, Christians Say Hollywood Ignores Them, But They Ignore Great Films About Faith.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of spurred on by the release of Silence, and the fact that, I mean, you know, again, part of it is probably marketing, part of it's because no one knew it was out there, but at the same time, you know, rated R Martin Scorsese film is not gonna, that, you know, I'm guessing, Joel, you're not taking the youth group to see this, you know.
I honestly If it was playing at more theaters in Portland, I actually looked into doing that with some high schoolers and talked to them about doing that.
So that's kind of the question. So if a parishioner comes up to you and says, should I go see this? I heard some people talking about it. Like, should I go see it? Like, do you recommend it? Are there any hesitations that you have? Are there any caveats? Is there a specific maturity level in someone's faith that you kind of want to, you know, you're kind of hoping they get to before you send, like, do you send a new Christian to see this? Do you send no one to see it? Do you, you know? So that's kind of my question.
I'm hesitant to censor anyone and say don't go see something, especially a movie like this. I consider this a very subversive movie. So that's why I actually think it's better than the quote unquote Christian genre, because it is actually more realistically a more realistic presentation and discussion of the faith than a God is Dead movie or, you know.
So I would imagine, or I'm kind of curious how you would liken it to, we've had a lot of good conversations about Calvary, and I think at one point you even said, I would make anyone thinking about going into the faith watch Calvary before they, you know.
Yeah, would I rank Silence above Calvary?
Second.
I still think Calvary is
the bee's knees.
It's the transforming power of self-sacrifice, which is the heart of the gospel. Yeah. So, but I think those two movies are great faith movies without them being faith movies. And that's what actually makes them better faith movies, to use the phrase.
So you don't have any hesitations about sending anyone, I mean, obviously, like, age appropriate.
Sure. I mean, I certainly would say if I knew someone it might be hard for them to reconcile how that could have been a good movie to see. I'd love to debrief them afterwards and ask them similar questions to that you're asking us and get them to think. But, oh, that Calvary is, I mean, gosh, whew, that's amazing. That's, I mean, great gospel without being overtly gospel.
Yeah. Well, it definitely, there's no ribbons tied on that one either.
Yeah.
So Joel, the terrible youth pastor taking his kids to the rated R movie.
Encouraging the rated R film. I totally would. I absolutely. The only caveat I think I would give would be that it's a difficult film. Like, it's not, there's not something about this that even, I keep thinking back, Alan, to the idea of this being a Liam Neeson action film or something. Like
yeah.
There's Liam Neeson and Kylo Ren is in it and Spider-Man's
right. I mean, and, some serious booty was going to get kicked in this movie.
Yeah.
And it's not, you know, it's 3 hours. It's
slow.
Yeah, it's fairly slow paced. There's a lot of sitting around of characters, you know, that don't really do that much. And then when things aren't sitting around, people are being tortured. And tortured in ways that are pretty awful. Not overly graphic, actually, which was interesting that it was rated R, to be honest. Like, I can think of PG-13 films that I've seen that I was more disturbed by the violence than this, in the sense of how gory it was or something like that.
Yeah.
This was disturbing to me because it's such a weighty kind of, like, when you involve faith and spirituality and this kind of torture, like persecution, religious persecution, I think that it, not that like war violence isn't the same or something, but there is a different dynamic to it, right? When you're pulling villagers out,
you're less sensitized to this kind of violence than you are.
Yeah.
Shoot them up, blow them up.
I feel like the only reason, well, not the only reason, but the, probably the main reason it got the R was because I think you can't have squirting blood in PG-13. Like, people can bleed a little bit.
The head chop.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's probably.
So that you, when you have the Scorsese moment that he works into, you know, the film, like, that's when it is like, they just hit the button and they're like, nope.
Right.
So,
and that's, I guess that's So all that to say, I would recommend a rated R film even to the high schoolers, and would take them gladly to go see it and talk about it. And mm-hmm. I agree with Alan that it's not something I would just say, hey, just go watch that, you know, pop it in for a date night or something like that.
And, date night.
Yeah, that kind of deal. Unless it's something that you really do want to discuss and wrestle with. And I would say in my recommendation, go watch it and let's talk about it. Or can I watch it with you so that we can discuss it and watch it prayerfully, I think is something too, to invite Jesus to be a part of that process. And I guess I'm specifically thinking about Christians in that realm.
Yeah.
For those of my friends who aren't Christians, I would say watch it also prayerfully but in a different way of what does this say to you about God and about Christianity and what are the questions that it raises? Because I've seen a number of film critics that I know are atheist or agnostic who have said that this is a film, or have read the book, that Endo's book is the closest that they've ever come to believing in God.
Well, and even Garfield acknowledges,
yes,
you know, by doing this film and considering Rodriguez, the Jesuit priest, he had this affection and affinity for the person of Jesus that grew.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he also says, that doesn't mean I believe, but gosh, I mean,
even but it's affecting.
The book and the movie made him draw towards the person of Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Like, you know, even language, I've heard him say, I fell in love with Jesus.
Yeah,
Christ. And that's
cool.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
And we'll see. I don't know what that means for his story and where he's headed. But I do think it's the kind of film that paints a picture of Christianity that is far more authentic to what it means to be a follower of Jesus mm-hmm. than a typical quote-unquote faith-based film like A God's Not Dead.
Mm-hmm.
And is ironically more evangelistically appealing and effective
mm-hmm.
in my mind. Not that that's the purpose. I still find that problematic when we turn films into, I suppose, like, this is going to sound harsh, but Christian propaganda to try to spread the message.
Right.
But I think when it's genuinely good art and something that we need to talk about and reveals truth, that people are drawn to truth. Yeah. And I think this goes back to something we were talking about earlier, and Mikey, when you said, when you talked about this being almost like scripture or like the Bible and how it's something that we see different times, that it's because it's true. It's revealing something that is true.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly true about Christ, about the cross, and doing it in such a way that we have to wrestle with.
Hmm.
And it doesn't, again, like, bring about all the nice, neat answers by the end, but it still does affirm faith.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's incredibly powerful and important.
Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's whenever you actually can, or someone can make art, and that art is honest.
Mm.
I think it does so much to strip back the layers of just BS.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, if you try to get someone who is not a believer, whether they classify themselves as agnostic or atheist, you know, or fallen away, whatever, however they want to classify themselves, when you give them a neatly packaged bow, that's when they start lobbing the grenades of like, well, I don't want to be a hypocrite, like you pretend you're perfect and you're not perfect, like that's what happens when you make a Christian propaganda film.
Mm.
Because everything's wrapped up, you're like, okay, well, why are you not happy? Why are you not nicer? I thought Jesus fixed all your problems. I mean, because that's what the movie says.
Yeah.
You know, even if people in the movie say, well, Jesus doesn't fix all your problems, that's not what the story says.
Right.
And so when you get to engage someone about the realities of working out your faith in a piece of honest art, you strip back all those, like, superficial arguments. And you say, what does faith look like to you now?
Yeah.
And they're like, oh my gosh. Like, yeah. You know, they're not making, like, yeah. Anyway, they're not making the superficial arguments, and it's it just I think the conversation starts from a much better place, and I think that's a positive thing. So I really appreciate you guys, diving in and asking pastoral questions. I know putting people on the spot for pastoral questions is always tough.
That's why we get the big money.
That's that's a vocational ministry. Yes. Money. But we are starting to run out of time, if not because we're about at time, but because it is literally after midnight here.
The night is young. So
before Alan and I fall asleep, I wanted to start wrapping us up by saying thanks. And I know it's not easy to get either of you guys for a sliver of time, so I appreciate you guys being here. Glad and I have really enjoyed this conversation. Again, even though I know we are scratching the surface, just based on the comments we're already having or we've been having in the discussion group. Based on Alexis's article over at realworldtheology.com. So if you would like to continue the conversation, I encourage anyone listening to go over to our Real World Theology discussion group at Facebook, or leave some comments over on realworldtheology.com, where Alexis has reviewed Silence and pitched a pretty grace-based message.
Mm-hmm. Good review.
That has sparked a lot of conversation. Mm-hmm. And I would also encourage you, even though the discussion kind of went this way, to realize that maybe it's not either or. It could possibly be both and. Mm-hmm. So I wind us down by saying that, and I think great conversations happen because you have great guests. So, so Joel, how can people interact with you or find you these days on the internet and the things that you're doing?
Yeah. Well, thanks again. I love being a part of these conversations and love being a part of the Real World Theology community. And even though right now I've presently deactivated Facebook and I'm not really on Twitter because of just personal emotional health, just to be totally honest, you can still find me in the my musings on film at cinemayward.com, cinemayward.com. That's probably the best way to find me on the internet right now.
Yep. And you'll find lots of cool things. I didn't bring this up. I was going to bring it up because I thought we were going to talk about Kichichiro specifically, but we kind of ended up just kind of weaving him into all of our conversations. But I really enjoyed Joel's, I want to call it a review, but it's not really a review. Would you say it was an Ignatian contemplation?
Yeah. So I used the idea of Ignatian contemplation and Ignatian prayer, where you use your imagination to enter into a story. And I think that's what Scorsese is doing with Silence. He's inviting us to enter into this story. And you see that with Rodriguez over and over again, where he imagines the face of Christ. So I tried to do something a little unique and different. I still don't know if I succeeded in just envisioning myself as Kichichiro and putting myself in that story and writing from the perspective of what he is seeing in the film and trying to dive into the narrative and some of the themes without giving away endings or things like that. But I found it was... I didn't know how else to write a review. I didn't know how else just to summarize, you know, major plot points and themes and things like that, because there's still so much. So this has been beneficial for me personally, just to talk through the film, because it's been difficult to find people who've seen it to really wrestle the questions that it's raised. So I'm deeply grateful for this conversation, and thank you to Mikey and to Alan.
Yeah, you too. It's great. Talk
Well, and like I said, there are so many reviews out there of Silence, because, like I said, I feel like at this point, almost anyone who's seen Silence is like a critic, or someone who is watching movies for some specific purpose, much like we do, What Joel does over at CinemaWord, specifically about Silence, is something that I don't think you will see anywhere else.
Yeah.
So I think it's worth checking out. Not that CinemaWord is not a great resource in general, because we use it all the time for show notes. So, so check that out. And you know, once Joel gets some of his mental health back, maybe you'll be able to catch him on social media.
Yes, absolutely.
But Alan, is there a way that people can follow you or follow the things?
Alan at redeemergso.org is my email address, and that's probably the best way to get in touch with me or connect.
Mm-hmm.
And I do have a Facebook page too, but I try to keep my Facebook page pretty vanilla, non-controversial. I like puppies and dogs and little kid pictures on my Facebook page, like the good old days of Facebook.
That's right. That, yes. For what it was created for.
Yes.
So I want that kind of Facebook. I want.
You want someone to make Facebook great again.
Right. Yeah. Oh no.
all the ways that you can get a hold of these guys will be in the show notes at realworldtheology.com under the podcast episode for Silence. So while you're there, check it out. Check out the ways you can get a hold of them. Like, again, go seek out our Facebook discussion group because, you know, it tends to be hopefully a fortress of solitude, mostly from some things in the outside world. Follow me on Twitter at Fizzification. Like I said, find me on Facebook, wherever I realize that I'm not able to disconnect from these worlds if I'm going to have people listen to the show. So
right.
I will be around. Like I said, I've just really enjoyed this conversation. I hope that more people go see this film.
Mm-hmm.
I really, really hope people, more than any other, this was my favorite film of 2016.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really surprised that anything was going to beat out Arrival for me because of what Arrival did for me on a personal level.
Mm.
But I hope if you've listened to this podcast, if you've seen this movie, especially if you saw it by yourself, find somebody and talk to them about this movie. Yeah,
absolutely.
It's worth spending some time on.
Mm.
So, as always, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. If you've enjoyed it, tell your friends, give us a 5-star review. It helps other people find us. And for Real World Theology, I'm Fizz, reminding you that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!
Wherever you are
is where I am.
Where you need to be.
Okay.